from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. When Bay Area doctor Vanessa Grubbs discovered that her boyfriend wasn't getting an urgently needed kidney transplant, she decided to donate one of her own kidneys. She'll join us in studio to talk about her new memoir, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. We'll also hear from Dr. Grubbs about problems with how we treat kidney disease. That's all coming up after this news. Welcome back to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. We'll be talking in this hour with Bay Area physician Vanessa Grubbs about her new memoir, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. But first, we want to update you on what's happening in the Senate today as Republicans attempt to reach a vote on a health care bill. And we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Mike DeBonis, who is congressional reporter for The Washington Post and who is right there on the Senate galley. joining us from D.C. in the gallery, excuse me. Good to have you with us, Mike DeBonis.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate your being with us. Well, they're expected to vote on a procedural vote, calling a motion to proceed on health care this afternoon. How close are we to a vote? And I guess John McCain's there as well, so they're waiting for him as well.
Yeah, we're within a couple hours of a vote. John McCain's scheduled to arrive just about right as that vote's scheduled to take place. It's going to be a really dramatic moment, and it's really quite unusual that we don't know what's going to happen here. Usually these things are pretty well choreographed in advance, and we know the positions of the various senators pretty well, and there's not a huge amount of drama. That's not the case here. There are a number of key lawmakers who have not said how they're going to vote, but many of them are in a private lunch now with the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, and we'll just sort of have to see what happens when they emerge from that, take to the floor and cast their votes.
Well, there may be some drama when Senator McCain appears because, as many people know, he's been struggling with glioblastoma, has a diagnosis of brain cancer. But if successful, the vote would allow debate to begin on repealing and replacing, I guess, technically, of what's known as Obamacare, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first step in passing any sort of bill that could do any number of things, and that's part of the drama. There seems to be no firm plan on what happens once they get on the bill. There is going to be a whole series of amendment votes starting almost immediately, and it can go in any number of directions. But it's still, while they may have the 50 votes to start debate, it's far from clear that they have that level of support for any of the alternatives that they're exploring.
Well, nobody expects this bill to become law. It would just essentially serve as a vehicle for Senate legislation, correct?
Right. Well, right. Well, the vote today, the first vote they're going to take is to start debate on a bill that, you know, if it's passed by the Senate and taken up by the House and passed by the House, would become law. So, you know, this isn't exactly a completely symbolic move here. This is real legislating happening. But there's a difference between starting the debate and finishing it, and that's the issue right now.
Well, there are also, even with all the wizardry that is often attributed to Mitch McConnell, there's kind of a one- or two-vote margin. With McCain there, it's maybe two votes now, but the only one who is defecting certainly is Senator Susan Collins of Maine.
She's the only firm no that we know about right now. Senator Rand Paul, who is, you know, basically raised many objections throughout the process and has long been sort of considered a no, said that he would vote for the motion to proceed earlier today. But he's seen as not necessarily being a reliable vote for whatever they end up coming up with at the end of the process. And then there's a whole segment of other senators, about a half dozen, who have not said what they're going to do and have been in fairly intense negotiations with the leadership in the White House and other party is about trying to get to yes. And then that's who we're going to be watching really closely here.
Well, I thank you, Mike DeBonis, and keep watching and keep covering. And Mike DeBonis, again, is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Good to have you with us.
Yep, my pleasure.
And we're going to talk with Vanessa Grubbs, as I said, and let me tell you a little bit about her and her book. She's with us for the rest of the hour. She's was a Bay Area primary care doctor, but discovered that her boyfriend wasn't getting the donated kidney that he desperately needed, so she decided to give him one of her own. And while going through the process, she discovered racial disparities in the way donated kidneys are allocated. Approximately 1 in 3 transplant candidates are African American, but they receive only 1 in 5 of all donated kidneys. And Dr. Grubbs joins us in studio to talk about her journey from kidney donor to kidney doctor and her new memoir, the title of which is Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. And welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you.
Happy to be here.
Well, two matches, not only a perfect match for a kidney, but the perfect match. You are now married to the man who is the recipient of your kidney. Let's talk about that love story first, because it's really compelling. And I know, I think your publishers pushed you kind of to tell that story, didn't they?
Yes. Originally, I was not planning to tell the personal story. The motivation for the book was to talk about how we make decisions around dialysis and the end of life. And my literary agent actually said, you know, Vanessa, nobody wants to buy a book about death, dying, and dialysis. You'll have to put your personal story in it.
Well, it is about, it's an educational book. It is all about dialysis. And of course, many people are concerned with what's going on with dialysis, especially the profiteering. And so we'll get into that, I hope, and racial biases, all of which you write about. But first, I do want to hear your story. And it all began, actually, it didn't begin necessarily on all that auspicious a note when you first met your husband.
No, it was not a love at first sight moment. We both worked for the same hospital. I was on faculty at an Oakland hospital, Highland. And he was on the board of trustees. And I was doing some program work, and it was important to me to meet all the various board members so that I could get them to, you know, help me advocate for me. And when I initially approached him, instead of responding like most of the others did, which is, oh, that's very interesting, tell me more, it was kind of like, yeah, hi. And what do you want?
You seemed a little aloof to you. Huh?
It was
standoffish.
Rude. Yes.
But you had a friend named Melanie who went to some lengths to get the two of you together.
It didn't start out that way. It started out that there was going to be a group of 7 or 8 of us gathering at her home to, you know, try to plan how we could help Robert better get through the kidney transplant process. And then it turns out it was just the 3 of us at her home. And then at one point she just got up and left, saying that she was going to get dessert. So at that point, it did very much feel like a setup.
Yeah. And like she wanted you both to be desserts for each other or something along those lines.
Ooh, okay.
Well, you know, you did become very attached to each other, and romance developed, and it's quite a story. You were a recent divorced mother.
Yes, yes. Actually, when we first met, when he was so rude to me, I was very much still married, and I had a little boy, 3 years old, and a year later, you know, lots can happen in a year. So I was actively divorcing, but definitely had a little boy.
And he said what to you about his dating life at that point?
Well, he said that he had lots of first dates, but not so many second dates. And that was because a lot of women just kind of, you know, once they realized what he was going through, they pretty much just ran for
the hills. Dialysis.
Yeah, yeah. It's I get how it could be scary for somebody who's not seen anything like that before.
He'd been on it for 5 years and 12 hours a week, as I
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had to go in 4 hours each time. He's a fairly big guy, and the bigger you are, the more kidney you need.
So you fall in love with this guy, and you decide, I'm going to give him my kidney. And he says, he kind of rejects the notion.
Right, yeah. His initial response was, no, I don't want to do that. And I didn't really fully understand what all went into his response until we were years into marriage. And really, as some of it, of the just guilt and burden of one, putting someone in harm's way, even though it's not that great of a risk to be a living kidney donor, but also to just feel you know, that obligation, like there's a person walking around looking at you to see if you're taking care of that kidney or not. And just feeling that extra burden of if you mess up, then there's, you know, there's somebody still alive.
But weren't there people close to him who said, I'll be a donor? And then it was more theoretical than like when it came down to the crunch?
Yeah, I mean... most people didn't tell him the details, but there were several people who came up and, you know, issues of other health concerns that led them to back away. And then, you know, I think it is something that people say, you know, it sounds good, but when it comes down to actually going in that operating room and, you know, things happening to you, I think that that becomes a bit different.
And it was also perhaps from some of your friends, maybe ill-advised. I mean, you didn't have an engagement ring.
I know. Yeah. People thought some people thought I was insane. My parents were supportive. Maybe that had to do with how they felt about my first husband. But they really love Robert. And when I took him home to visit, they could see how he felt on a day to day. And while we were there, we had to arrange for him to have dialysis. And that was a 2-hour drive away. So I took him there. He sat there for 4 hours, and then I drove him back to home. So my parents could definitely see.
Talking with Vanessa Grubb, she's an associate professor of medicine and a nephrologist at the University of California, San Francisco, also the author of Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. And when Robert found out he was eligible, things moved along in a rather strange way. You had to go through an evaluation. He made it to the top, and suddenly you felt, and I'll be very frank about this, that it was like a inquisition that was tinged by racism.
Well, that's certainly what it felt like to us, not being privy to every other conversation. But it certainly felt just suspicious at best, and that people were trying to talk him out of even wanting a kidney transplant. Just from telling him that it would be a lot more time for him, or this is how much it will cost after your insurance, and can you afford that? And, you know, some people actually find great community at their dialysis units, and that's better for them than a transplant. So
is that customary, though, those kinds of things? That's at least my understanding. I mean, asking about insurance, for example, and saying, are you sure you can afford this?
And I guess it is. And, you know, that's a big issue. But, you know, my concern is that, you know, we've been through this before, particularly with dialysis. It was something that was really expensive that people couldn't afford. And then the government figured out a way to take care of it when they felt like deserving people were dying. So, you know, my point is that, and I make this in the book as well, is when there's something that we want for the people that we feel most deserving, we don't allow, insurance and other issues that I think a lot of disproportionately poor or people of color get kind of pushed aside for.
Well, there are racial disparities. I mean, it takes two years longer to get a kidney transplant for someone of color than it does for a white person.
Yeah, it definitely was not just in our heads. There's lots of data to support that, and how it takes black folks much longer at each step to get through each step towards transplant. So, and just going through that process with Robert, because I, as a primary care doctor, I wasn't really invited into that circle at all. So it was all quite surprising to me. And I certainly felt like there were a lot of system level issues that created the outcomes that we see. And once I became a nephrologist, I could see all of the nuances that even came up before people entered the kidney transplant center itself.
We're talking to Vanessa Grubbs, who again is now a nephrologist and also the author of Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. And let's talk about dialysis. You write about it a good deal in the book, and the book is really highly educational. I've been for many, many years now MC of the National Kidney Foundation luncheons, literary luncheons in San Francisco, and I just had a couple of kidney stones, so I know more about kidneys maybe than I want to know, but certainly from the working with the Kidney Foundation, have learned a lot about kidneys and learned an extraordinary amount from your book. And I want to talk about dialysis because there's here in California, for example, we need some legislation, particularly about the number of workers. Minimum staffing levels in California are really not there like they are in other states. And you've got some people who are handling as many as, monitoring as many as 10 or more patients at the same time. I mean, it's And it's very aggressive. It's aggressive also in terms of big companies, big corporations, DaVita and Fresenius. These are companies that make about to the tune of $4 billion in their profits over the course of, say, just the year 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of push to get people into dialysis.
Yes, it is big business, unfortunately. And,
big lobbying, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I practice at San Francisco General, the county the county hospital where, I don't know, it seems almost against the rules that we make any money. So I don't feel like we're that much affected in terms of staffing and things. We always have two nurses on duty for our 13-chair unit. So, and I do agree when it comes to the private sector trying to maximize profit, I think it does push forward some or brings up some kind of perverse incentives, which are not necessarily in the best interest of the patients that we take care of.
Well, there is a Senate bill in the works. It's up to the Assembly in California now, Senate Bill 349, which is called the Dialysis Patient Safety Act. It would change dialysis for about 66,000 Californians, particularly in terms of the number of staff, but also things like more recovery time and all that. I wanted to actually have us hear something about dialysis. Many people are familiar with Last Week Tonight and John Oliver. I guess you know about this, Dr. Grubbs?
Yes. I saw the show, and there was a lot of conversation about it, for sure.
Well, the industry, the dialysis industry, was the target of John Oliver, and let's hear a cut.
The story of dialysis is an amazing case study of good intentions being thwarted by bad incentives, poor oversight, and profiteering.
What's he talking about there?
Well, I for the most part, I do think he was on point. There were some nuances that maybe they didn't get exactly right, but I do agree. At the end of the day, our system is set up for profiting, and that I think most of us, most providers are, we want to do what we think is in the best interest of our patients, but it makes it difficult when we get paid by, how many patients we see in a given period of time. And we get paid more for people who are on dialysis and not so much, someone in the clinic setting. So, and certainly, you don't get paid once people go off to transplant, at least from the dialysis unit. So there are a lot of system level issues at play that kind of feed into this, kind of maintaining a system that is certainly less than ideal.
He had a couple of funny lines, though. He talked about, dialysis is the one form of socialized medicine. So he says there's only one organ that belongs in Canada, and that's the kidney. But he also at one point said, we're paying for a fully loaded Lamborghini and getting a drunk donkey on roller skates.
Yeah, lots of jokes. Yeah.
We're talking again with Vanessa Grubbs. She's associate professor of medicine and a nephrologist, University of California, San Francisco, author of Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. And let me give out a phone number because I know some of you have some thoughts about, not only dialysis, but you may want to talk with Dr. Grubbs about your kidneys or about kidneys in general. I mean, she goes into a whole history in the book about how kidneys used to have a lot more importance attached to them back in the day, when they reigned, so to speak. They were the seat of moral yearning and righteous action. We do invite your participation in the program. You can join the conversation with any questions or comments, and the toll-free number is available now. That number is 866-733-6786. And if you had experience as a donor or a recipient, I'd certainly like to hear from you. Or if you're waiting for an organ, I'd like to hear from you as well. Again, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And, of course, you can also join us by going to our Facebook page. I mentioned before we went on the air, maybe TMI, too much information. I just passed a couple of kidney stones a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, I went online and got all of my blood levels and everything, and creatinine. there's a separate category for African Americans.
Yes, there is. And that's something that has very much bothered me, because I think it can have very real negative impact for some black patients. And the separation comes from a study that was published in 1999, where the researchers examined about 1,600 black and white people to try to come up with equations so that we could estimate kidney function using the blood test creatinine. Now, because we tend to lose muscle mass as we get older, and because we men tend to have more muscle mass than women, and creatinine is something that is a breakdown product of muscles that's released pretty constantly every day. Both age and gender are in the equations, but they also suggested that if the patient was black, that we needed to multiply by 1.2, because what they observed is that the blacks in their study tended to have higher muscle mass than whites. And so this one study was pretty much generalized to the entire population. And what's bothered me about it is that not only does it assume that even though the study included just a couple hundred black folks, that, you know, everybody is the same. All black folks are exactly the same. And then it excluded everybody else who has very different frames, like our Native Americans, American Samoans, Latinos, Asians. None of these folks are in were included in the study. So they're just assumed not black. And, you know, in the day to day, I certainly don't think most of us as clinicians are remembering that this race is supposed to be a proxy for muscle mass when we're sitting in front of the patient in front of us.
Again, we're talking to Vanessa Grebs, and she is a nephrologist, formerly a primary caregiver, just a small town gal from North Carolina who now has authored a book called Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers. Remember when Sam Irvin used to talk about, you know, I'm just a folksy guy from North Carolina, or words to that effect, going back to the water. I'm thinking about Watergate a lot these days, naturally. and I'm thinking about kidneys a lot, too, especially after reading your book. I mean, what you learn from your book is just how important the kidneys are. And a lot of people don't realize they should get their kidneys checked just as regularly as they get about everything else checked, because so much else is related. You say at one point you didn't even know, and you were primary care doctor, how much fertility was related to kidneys.
Right. And that was really a lot of the motivation for writing the book in the first place, is that, you know, I can see, and we have much documentation of how little people know about the kidneys and kidney disease. So I really wanted to have this book out there to try to educate as wide an audience as possible about all the various issues that come into play, and particularly around dialysis and end of life. And that's why it's written for a general audience.
It's a highly educational book, and it's also a twofer, because you get this love story, and you get Dr. Grubbs talking about just the effect that this man had on her life. Talk a little bit about that maybe when we come back. She uses the word twirl on a couple of occasions, and the book has its charms. We do invite, again, you to join the program, and we do welcome your involvement. You can call us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Here's a listener. Well, I'll read some comments when we return, and we'll talk about Robert. Maybe talk a little about that woo-woo stuff with the other person by the same name that you write about. More when we return. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are spending this hour with Vanessa Grubb. She's Associate Professor of Medicine and a nephrologist at UC San Francisco, also the author of Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. We're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith, but I just have to tell you that I was talking to Dr. Grubbs off air about some very funny moments in her book, talking about how it's educational, has a love story. And there's one moment where she's being examined to find out if she matches in blood with Robert, her soon-to-be husband. She says, they're going to give her a rectal exam. And she says, I'm not middle-aged and I don't have a prostate. Your finger does not need to go there. I also laughed when you made the distinction between sing and sang. Give us that.
Yes, that was referring to I write about
preaching.
Yes, I write in the book about our wedding, and there were a couple of mishaps, as I'm sure happen at any wedding, but there was this one part in particular where the wedding coordinator was just kind of sitting there enjoying the ceremony rather than making sure that the unity candle was there. And so that is, for people who aren't familiar with that, the mothers would light the far candles, and in the center there's a candle for the couple, and each, you know, the husband and wife would each take from their mother's candle and light the middle. And so it was this thing about uniting as this new couple. But since the wedding coordinator forgot to put it there, the preacher started, as we say, preaching. He wasn't just, you know, saying a few words. He was like, you know, we don't need a unity candle because the candle is already lit. And so I'm trying to explain how that is similar to how someone can sing in that they can just carry a tune, but somebody who can sing, they can bring you to tears with, you know, just the beauty of their voice. And the same difference about the difference between preaching and preaching.
I love that distinction. And I mentioned that you write also about Robert Phillips, your husband, mm-hmm. The one to whom you gave a kidney, and get into his history. And he's a kid out of Richmond, described his youth as being kind of a knucklehead. And
yeah.
you describe him as being both a combination of nerd and thug and metrosexual, and you seem to love that combination.
Well,
but
a good combo, yeah.
I was struck by something you wrote, because he was, as a young kid, he was getting in trouble, as many kids do in Richmond,
mm-hmm.
Selling drugs. And the distinction, selling crank to whites but weed to fellow blacks.
Well, he said that's what people wanted. You give the people what they want. So, unfortunately,
he got out of that life, though.
Yes, he grew out of his knucklehead stages. Otherwise, I don't think there would have been a Vanessa and Robert. He's more nerd now than a knucklehead.
Well, here's a listener who writes, I am on hemodialysis, but I got trained to do it at home with my husband, so I am advocating for home dialysis if possible for patients. It is vastly superior treatment to doing it in clinics. I get more dialysis, which is important. I feel great, lots of energy. I'm on the transplant list at UCSF, but there's an 8-year wait. I have 3 years to go, but with home hemo, I will be fine in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. No, I wish, I'm glad to hear that the person is doing really well. And I too wish that we had more people who were doing home either hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis, which is like through the abdomen. And there was a survey, I'm not remembering the year at this moment, but of nephrologists, and 93% said that they would do a home dialysis treatment if a kidney transplant wasn't readily available. And I think that's because, well, one, it's like a type A personality thing. You like to have control over things. But also, I think people do feel much better, just more even, since the dialysis is happening every day, rather than what is unfortunately more popular in this country, and when people go just 3 times a week. And it's like this, you know, just up and down with your body. But I think some of it has to do with the way our system is set up. And two, I think the people, at least the ones that I come across, are generally afraid of dialysis at home, which is unfortunate, because it's not like you need any kind of medical degree to be able to do it. But we make it so much easier to do the in-center hemodialysis, and a bit harder to do home hemo or peritoneal dialysis. And I think there's lots of things that could be done to improve that.
Well, people are afraid of home things in general. I mean, a lot of people obviously resist home birth or any, you know,
well, yeah,
you want to be in a hospital.
Yeah, they assume that's better.
A clinic, yeah.
But, you know, mortality is similar. But in terms of the quality of life, I think, you know, if it were me, I would do something at home as well.
And you have some of these clinics for profit that are a little bit like fast food joints?
People go in by shifts, and it's a definite turnaround so that you can get through as many people as possible in a given day.
Yeah.
And I think, too, nephrologists tend to recommend what they're most familiar with. And, you know, through our training, we see mostly in-center hemodialysis. I myself have not taken care of somebody on home hemodialysis, but I would have to refer them to a place that does it.
Well, here's Lisa from Richmond, who is on home hemodialysis. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. In fact, I am the one that sent that email, so thank you for sharing that. And I really love your comments, doctor, that you made about home hemodialysis.
Thank you.
I have PKD, polycystic kidney disease, which is an inherited condition. And I am on the transplant list, as I noted, and I think I have maybe 3 or 4 years more to go. And I have actually had 5 people go through the donor process, and it's a very high bar. And, of course, I'm in my 60s, so everyone my age has a little something, you know, so mm-hmm. it's very hard bar to reach. But, yes, the home hemo is really great, I think. And my husband and I went through a 6-week training process, and he's a huge help to me, of course. But I do try to do most of it myself so that, you know, he doesn't suffer from caregiver burnout too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really believe it's such a good treatment method. And, you know, I do feel really good. My labs are really good. And I guess what you said is kind of true about the type A personality. I do like being in control of it. And but, you know, you have flexibility so that you are not just stuck with the clinic schedule. So if there's some special event in your life, you can kind of schedule it around that. And you are getting more dialysis. Which
you're making the case for home dialysis here, Lisa.
Yeah.
And thank you for actually bringing that to the fore here. I'm also interested in finding out your thoughts, Dr. Grubbs, about the transplant list. There have been, you know, rumors through the years that if people have money, they can buy kidneys on the open market, I suppose. But that's a whole other subject for discussion.
Yeah.
But there's always been, and I won't name names here, but there's always been suspicion cast on people who have particular wealth or fame being able to move up that list very quickly. And yet the folks who are behind it say, no, absolutely not.
Well, I think the thing that the caller did say is that the wait in this area can be 8, but up to 9 years. And some of that depends upon just geography. You can go to a different area where they get the organs from a different, what they call OPO, an organ procurement organization, and the wait can be much shorter, like 3 to 5 years. And the thing is, how wealth helps that is you can figure out wherever in the country the list is shorter and just go there. But poor people, poorer people, don't have the opportunity to go to different places and try to get on a shorter list.
Let me get another caller on. Nung, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Grubb, for shining such a great topic because it's really important and it's just really crazy how kidney disease has such an impact on our communities and families, and it needs more public awareness. For me personally, I'm a living donor, and I donated my kidney to my brother when he was diagnosed at an early age of 25 and he was on dialysis for 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And I did my kidney transplant process through Stanford Healthcare. What I found was the hospital was a great resource, but the community with the National Kidney Foundation was my main resource to connect with peers who went through the same living donation process so I could foresee what kind of challenges I would face. And I just really want to shout out the National Kidney Foundation for all the work they've done.
Well, good of you to do that. Like I say, I've been doing the literary luncheon now for over 20 years, and I think they do terrific work. Wouldn't do it every year if I didn't think that. Thank you for the call. Let me bring another caller right on here, and that's Kim from Emeryville. Kim, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Oh, good. I just wanted to make a quick comment and question. My aunt, who was Korean, she gave her kidney to her brother. She was very healthy, very active. This was about 10, 12 years ago. Recently, she developed colon cancer, and she passed fairly quickly. I'm just wondering if giving the kidney compromised her immune system in any way.
Okay. Kim, thank you for that. Appreciate hearing from you. And Bill writes, my sister, who was diabetic, eventually lost the use of her kidneys and was on traditional dialysis in a hospital for a few years. Then she was offered the option of enteral dialysis, in which the patient fills their abdomen with a fluid through an abdominal shunt, lets the fluid absorb the body's impurities, and empties it at home. She greatly appreciated that option since she could do personal things sitting on her couch. Is that still an option, and do most dialysis patients qualify?
So answering the caller's question first in terms of the immune system, the kidneys are certainly involved in our immune system. is pretty central in Chinese medicine. We don't have any, at least I'm not aware of any direct links that say that, you know, if you're down one kidney, you're automatically going to be at greater risk of any of other things. There is a slight increased risk that donors will go on to develop end-stage kidney disease, but I think a lot of that can be undone if donors can stay healthy. That's the thing. And for me personally, I certainly the small increased risk of donating to my own health certainly didn't matter at nearly as much as what good I could do by actually being a donor. And I would certainly advocate for anyone who is healthy to consider it. And I would do it again if I could go back in time. And what the email was about was what I was mentioning a minute ago, peritoneal dialysis, where you do get a catheter that's surgically implanted into your abdomen. And the person does fill the space between their skin and the abdominal organs with the dialysis fluid, and the covering over our abdominal organs is a membrane that actually can function like a kidney filter. And that's what we do in the in-center hemodialysis. There's a filter that tries to take the place of the kidney. So yes, this is something that we very much do. And I certainly would like to see us do more of it just in terms of how people can feel better on a day-to-day. Not to say that the in-center hemodialysis people don't, that they're always feeling awful, but I think just because of the kind of the up and down that your body goes through, there is certainly lots more fatigue and people with cramping and dietary restrictions that are really difficult for folks on the 3 times a week dialysis.
The operation, the surgery that you went through when you donated your kidney to Robert, your Robert,
mm-hmm.
for a couple of cases, my Robert, it was tougher for him. He had to go through 2 more operations after the surgery. You were out there jogging, as a donor.
I wouldn't say that.
Well, you say it in the book. You say, you know, he had to go through 2 more. But I mean, you as a donor didn't have to go through nearly what he had to go through.
Oh, no. It was nothing in comparison. But yes, he did have pretty complicated course that is not the usual. And that was because he had prior surgeries where they would normally try to put in the new kidney. And so the surgeon at the time, instead of trying to get through that scar tissue, he did what they sometimes do in other cases. But for Robert, just a kind of a workaround, but it didn't work. And it was really tough. And he suffered a lot during that hospitalization. And we're just extremely thankful that after the third attempt, that it was the surgical, like the plumbing was corrected. And he hasn't required dialysis since we left the hospital. And that's been a full 12 years ago.
And I alluded to this earlier. There was another Robert Phillips.
Yes.
Who happened to be a white man. But there was a sign that came to you because of this other Robert
Phillips?
Yeah.
When I started dating Robert, I really wasn't considering that I would be the source of his kidney. And he told me about when he had just started dialysis, he was doing some research and trying to find out more about transplant because his nephrologist, unfortunately, hadn't talked to him about it. And people around him thought it was a really bad idea. And he came across this man, Robert Phillips, who I think from Virginia, a truck driver. And for me, when I was just sitting in a pediatrician's office for my son's just well baby check, and I was flipping through a magazine, and I came across the celebration. I think it was like the 40th year celebration or something for this Robert Phillips guy. And so for me, at that point, I had already decided that I wanted to donate. But at my core, I'm a very superstitious country girl. So that had a lot of meaning for me.
You can take the girl out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the
it.
Girl.
No.
Vanessa Grubbs here with us in studio. And by the way, she'll be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 o'clock. And we'll be speaking with another caller, and that's you, Winston from Oakland. Welcome.
Oh, hello. Thank you. I just have a question with the doctor. For people who currently have healthy kidneys, what can we do to prevent kidney damage in the future, whether it be through diet or what have you?
Yes, I think there are a lot of things that people do. And one is just early detection. But in terms of not just lowering your risk, you know, diabetes and high blood pressure cause 2/3 of the chronic kidney disease that we see in this country. So trying to maintain a healthy weight, not too much salt, alcohol in moderation, and not smoking, all of those things will make sure to keep a person healthy. But for anyone who has things that run in their family, or maybe they've been told that they have diabetes or prediabetes or whatever, you can get tested. It's a simple blood test and a urine test. And if you are a healthy person, I would say at least annually, but of course these things should be done more often if you already know that you have some kidney damage. And this is so important because people can't wait until something hurts with the kidneys, because nobody has symptoms, or at least very few people have any symptoms at all until the kidneys are almost gone. So it's just so sad to see patients not come to our attention until they've developed some symptoms, because then there's not nearly as much as we can do then to help slow down the progression of the kidney disease.
Let me thank the caller. You take you call yourself a country gal, country girl. You take exception to that kind of designation?
No.
Because there are apparently listeners who think you should take exception to it.
I'm a proud country girl, so, you know.
That's what you describe yourself as.
I think it all gives, you know, it creates who I am. I'm also a physician, a mother, a black woman. You know, I'm lots of things, and it's all wrapped up into one.
An author as well.
An author and a patient, and yes, all of that.
A donor.
Yes.
And here's another caller. Brian, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. First off, thanks for taking my call. My wife was recently diagnosed with end-stage renal failure, and so we're looking at, you know, all the options as far as treatment and things like that. And I'm concerned hearing that African-Americans don't seem to fare as well in the system as maybe someone that's Caucasian or you know, another ethnicity. What can I do to be proactive in making sure that my wife will get the treatment that she really needs?
Well, it sounds like you are very much ahead of the game already, just because, one, you know what's going on and you're looking for solutions. I think what often happens to people of color is it just feeds into some of the disparities that we see above and beyond. Of course, there's people are carrying their unconscious and conscious biases that I think get in the way. And one important place where that gets in the way is only a patient can only be considered for kidney transplant if their nephrologist refers them. So you think about in terms of people having access to care, so many people don't know that they have kidney disease. They don't have access to primary care, much less specialty care with a nephrologist. And of course, that person has to look at you and consider you a good candidate and actually make the referral. So then insurance is a big factor, because that costs for a person to go through evaluation. So I think some of our various social determinants of health very much get in the way of people getting through the process at the same rate. And I think there's a lot of misperceptions about what it requires. For example, some people think you have to be the same race. And, you know, I'd like to stress that, you know, race is a social construct. It's not something that you find on your DNA. And the only race that matters in terms of kidney transplant is the human race. And then I think what is makes it difficult, too, particularly if people are trying to stick within the same race, is that, unfortunately, blacks and Latinos in this country have a much higher rate of developing kidney failure than whites. And so it makes it that much more difficult to find a suitable living donor within your family, because certainly if you have even low early signs of diabetes or high blood pressure or any kidney disease, that will disqualify you as a potential donor.
Here's a listener who wants to know, do you have any advice or resources for people who are considering being donors? It's something I've always considered, but I'm not out of my childbearing years yet. Is there an optimal time to donate?
Well, you know, each center has their various guidelines. They don't want to take a kidney from someone too young. So most centers, as far as I'm aware of, they won't take someone before, say, age of 25, because some conditions you can't even diagnose until a little older. And then they don't want to take a kidney from someone that is, you know, a bit on the older side. But everything is relative. It depends on the person. And you just have to, you know, inquire. In terms of the, you know, the baby making, I can't really answer that question. And supposedly there is a that women who have donated are similarly as able to conceive as women in the general population. And of course, that, you know, has its own factors included. It's like for me, I talk about in the book that after, you know, I assumed that I would be able to conceive after donation, but it turns out it didn't happen for us. But some of that is because I was, you know, I had that advanced maternal age working against me as well. So, but in terms of finding out more information, I do know the National Kidney Foundation does have lots of information. And another shout out to NKF is that they're sponsoring the event tonight at Book Passage. So I'm very happy about that. But then I think just talking to people, like, for example, when I'm talking with patients, because folks really struggle with considering to ask somebody for a kidney. And so I very readily share my experience so people can know that it's not so scary, and that, you know, you're doing this wonderful, incredible thing that I don't think you'll ever regret.
I have a friend who gave a kidney to her hairdresser, and she says, if it's a match, I'll give you mine. I mean, you know, just mm-hmm. enormously generous and extraordinary act for someone to do that. It's always kind of takes my breath away, to tell you the truth. Here's Franny. Franny joining us from Castro Valley. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a brief comment about waiting lists. I've been on the Stanford waiting list for 4 years. I was originally told it would be 3 to 5 years, and now they tell me it's 7 years. But I found out that another transplant center a little bit east of the Bay Area has a wait list for my blood type that is only 3 years. So I'm actually now on that wait list, and my wait time is exceeding what they require for my blood test, for my blood type. So the, people should go on the web and Google wait times for kidney transplants, and it is amazing the difference in various centers.
Well, good luck to you. And as Dr. Grubb said earlier, you know, some of it depends on where you live. But there was, looking in your book now, the kidney allocation system with what you say is a new rule back in December 2014.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that was a very positive step.
It's a turning point, really. Wasn't it?
Yes. And basically what that new rule said was that people would get credit for their time on dialysis. And that would help undo a lot of the problems that we were seeing that fell along racial lines, and that it took people of color a lot longer to get through the process. So this rule basically took that off the table and said, so even if it takes you a year or two after dialysis to actually get on the list, we'll put your wait list time back to when you started dialysis. Mm-hmm. And so I say this is a positive step, but it's not really enough, because people could get listed, get on that wait list long before they start dialysis. So, for example, people usually start dialysis when their kidneys are just filtering at like a rate of 5 to 8 milliliters every minute. And you can get on the list when your kidneys are still filtering at 20 milliliters every minute. And the difference between those two, even though they sound like very low numbers, it can be many years, and which is how some people who have, again, access to a nephrologist, know that they have kidney disease and are getting regularly tested, can get on that list and get what we call a preemptive transplant before dialysis without ever having to do any dialysis time.
Let me bring on another caller. Masood is our next caller. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
You're welcome, Michael. Thank you for taking the call, and I appreciate you airing this program along with your guests to increase the awareness within the community about donation of kid live donor kidney. I myself am recipient of two kidneys from two live donors, my siblings. I received one from my sister back in 1984, and I lived with it for about 20 years, and then when it failed again due to my autoimmune problem, my brother walked in and he donated one kidney to me, and I've been living for the past 35 years with a kidney transplant. I've been active, I've been working, I'm still active, I'm 7 years old and still going. And my siblings are quite healthy. They both have their good, normal life. And even my sister had one child after she donated a kidney to me back in 84. So it's been quite a journey, but I just want to comment that people who want to consider donate kidney, there are concerns for their health, but the chance of getting hurt or develop complications with the donation of the kidney is almost none.
Yeah, Masood, you make an important point, and I think Dr. Grubbs makes the point in her book, and I thank you for that call. And Dr. Grubbs, a listener, wants to know, what were the odds that you'd actually be a compatible donor for your husband? Do we know? Any idea what those odds were?
You know, I don't think it's nearly as hard as people think. In fact, at the time, they only looked at 6 genetic markers, and Robert and I only had 1 in common. So it's just a testament to how excellent the medications are now.
Well, it's been a delight to have you here. I thank you, and thank you particularly for all the educational elements that you provide, as well as the love story, which is a twirl.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
And Vanessa Grubbs will be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 p.m. She is a nephrologist and associate professor at University of California, San Francisco. Her book, again, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.